Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Let's everybody shout and shimmy! Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flame.
Well, that's right, it's star time. This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. Later on the program, Moroccan instrumentalist Hassan Hakmoun got his start playing in the markets of Marrakesh, but he's been bringing the spiritual music of Morocco around the globe and here to our studio today. Also, musical hotspots to watch out for in 2007. But we begin with James Brown, the singer, songwriter, band leader, dancer. The hardest-working man in show business died on Christmas Day. He was set to play a New Year's Eve gig at the famed Apollo Theater. And back in 1962, his career practically exploded on that Harlem stage. Joining us with the story of that night is Douglas Wolk, music critic and contributor to Rolling Stone, Slate, and author of the book Live at the Apollo. Douglas, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks very much, John.
So, Live at the Apollo, the album does not include James Brown's what would become his greatest hits. Why is this record so highly thought of?
This is really the record where he broke out to a national audience, an album audience, and a pop audience beyond the R&B listeners that he'd really played to before. It's just an extraordinary performance. It's half an hour of absolute soul meltdown.
Now, he had played the Apollo before. What was so special about what was going on at the Apollo on this particular occasion?
Well, this was the middle of a week-long engagement he had at the Apollo, playing 6 days in a row, playing five shows a day. At this point, he was touring 300 days a year, playing up to five shows every day. But this particular show, the show that was recorded as Live at the Apollo, happened on October 24th, 1962, which was right smack in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So he was playing in front of 1,500 people who thought there was a pretty good chance they were going to be dead inside the week. And everybody was... It was an excitable audience.
And so your book actually... You know, in addition to giving us kind of chapter and verse of what's going on stage, also cuts back to what's happening at NORAD Central and, you know, in the Oval Office in the White House, and basically giving us some context. You mentioned that, you know, he was already doing 300 shows a year, doing multiple shows a day, hence the hardest working man in showbiz nomer.
Yeah, that wasn't just a nickname.
Yeah. Who, though, were these audiences that he was playing to? Now, you mentioned he was trying to cross over. Who was his initial audience?
His initial audience was, you know, African-American listeners in big urban markets in the North, and especially in the South, where he toured on what was then called the Chitlin' Circuit, the little clubs where black performers could play and tour just about constantly. People who listened to his records, people who heard his records on the radio. He was famous for promoting his records on the radio absolutely everywhere he went. The joke was that if you had a ham radio in your bedroom, he'd do 10 minutes of interview with you.
And the Apollo Theater, for all its, you know, glamour and its reputation, this was considered part of that Chitlin' Circuit.
Yeah, absolutely. It was sort of the crown jewel of the Chitlin' Circuit. If you played at the Apollo had and still has very, very tough audiences. I'm sure if you've seen... the TV show, you've seen people get booed off
the
stage.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could impress them, you could make it anywhere.
And there were some very famous musical names that got started on that stage.
Oh, virtually every African-American musician of any importance from the 30s to the 60s or 70s played at the Apollo. I mean, that was the sign that you'd made it.
All right. Now, so you mentioned it's this particular night. Did you say October 24th of 1962?
October 24th, 1962, yes.
Okay. Middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. You've also got a growing civil rights movement. Do you also have amateur night? Is this the amateur night audience, the rowdy amateur night audience that he's playing to?
Oh, yes. They might have given a few people their walking papers earlier in the evening.
Okay. But not to James Brown. Why don't we hear a little bit from the 1962 classic recording, James Brown, Live at the Apollo.
Sounds great.
The late James Brown. He died on Christmas Day. He was actually scheduled to play New Year's Eve here in New York, not actually at the Apollo, but at B.B. King's, although it is at the Apollo that the big sort of memorial took place. Appropriately, we are talking about the album James Brown Live at the Apollo, recorded in 1962. Douglas Wolk wrote the book, literally, on this record. That is James Brown. The song Try Me is James Brown in a, for him, a pretty sedate mode. And yet, as soon as he starts singing, there's that audience just shrieking, screaming. Is this why he pushed so hard to make this record, that he wanted that kind of electric effect of him and the audience?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even when he was the most popular musician in the country, pretty much, he still wanted more than anything else to make it. He had this unbelievable drive all through his career, just pushing and pushing and pushing. You can hear that in the performance, the absolute molten passion of it.
So the idea was that, I take it from what you've written, that he modeled this on a Ray Charles record, the Ray Charles 1959 album In Person.
Yes.
And of course, there'd been many, many live albums before he decided to make this. But for a guy whose reputation was built on touring, on his sort of incandescent stage presence, this seemed to be a no-brainer. And yet, the story goes, the record almost did not get made.
Well, Sid Nathan, who was the fellow who was running his record label, King Records, is famous for a number of terrible business decisions that somehow his business survived. One of them was that when James Brown came to him and said, oh, I want to make a live record, he said, nah, live records don't sell, it'll never fly. So James Brown actually paid out of his own pocket to have the Apollo show recorded and turned into a tape. And of course, once anybody actually heard what the record sounded like, it just took off like a shot.
So this must have, he must have been a pretty savvy businessman pretty early in his career to be able to, to have the financial wherewithal to rent the hall, to rent the equipment, to pay the ushers to wear tuxedos, as you point out in your book.
Yeah.
To tape all these shows, to put it all together. There was more to the guy than just the ability to sweat musically on stage.
Oh, right. Absolutely. He was an extraordinary businessman for his entire career, even right up to the end. A few years ago, I know he sold bonds against the future use of his back catalog for millions and millions of dollars. I don't have the exact figure, but he did clear a very healthy sum even just a few years ago.
All right. Now, you argue in the book, Live at the Apollo, that this James Brown record, quote, made a new kind of pop record, unquote.
Great.
What is new about this?
It's new because it was no longer based on, here's a 3-minute pop song, here's another 3-minute pop song. Live at the Apollo was meant to be heard as one long, continuous performance. Some of the songs just last 11 or 12 or 15 seconds. He just touches on them to remind his audience of, you know, oh, this was a hit, and moves on. Some of them go on much longer. The centerpiece of the album is Lost Someone, which is 10 minutes long. There is no such thing as a 10-minute song in 1962, except there is.
Right.
Live at the Apollo, and there it is.
Lost Someone is the centerpiece of this classic 1962 recording. Let's hear, we won't hear 10 minutes of it, but let's hear a little bit from James Brown. James Brown smoldering on stage at the Apollo that October night in 1962. We're speaking with Douglas Wolk, who, among other things, has written the book Live at the Apollo, a sort of history of the making of this record, the context in which it was made. You said, Douglas, that this was a new form of pop record. One of the novelties was this song, so long at 10.5 minutes, that it actually on the original LP fades down in the middle of the song to end side one and then fades right up to begin side two.
Yeah, when people would call radio stations to request to hear this record, they wouldn't ask for a song. They would just ask for, I want to hear James Brown live at the Apollo. So there would be radio stations that would play the entire album straight through once or twice a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so this really was a crossover at a time when, you know, the civil rights movement was just beginning to pick up steam. Here's an African-American guy who's really, as you say, has been playing the so-called Chitlin circuit. Did this break him out of that? Did this make him a kind of crossover artist on the order of a, you know, a Chubby Checker or somebody like that?
It did and it didn't. I mean, his first allegiance was always to the audience he'd started out from, but he wanted to reach everybody. He went through a number of periods in his career where he was trying to reach a different kind of audience. There was a period in the late 60s where he wanted to be Frank Sinatra very badly, and he was playing in Vegas, and he was singing That's Life and singing, you know, all these standards. There was a period around 1970 where he decided to reach out to, you know, the underground rock kids and recorded an album and a single and some other stuff with an acid rock band. He was an amazingly, amazingly versatile musician. He was a jazz musician. He was a rock musician. He was a pop musician. He was a soul musician. And he invented funk. And he invented funk 5 years after the Apollo recording. I mean, if he'd called it quits after recording Live at the Apollo, he would still be remembered as one of the greatest American musicians ever, and he hadn't even gotten to the good stuff yet.
Well, you know, you're saying he's a rock musician, he's a jazz musician, he's a soul musician. He's got a little bit of a preacher in him, too. You know, when we heard the beginning of Lost Someone,
right,
the crowd is right there with him. There's this kind of tent revival meeting vibe going on.
Absolutely. You know, he grew up going to church services. He grew up singing gospel. He started singing gospel actually when he was in prison, when he was a teenager, sang with a fellow named Johnny Terry, who went on to be one of the famous Flames, who sang with him.
Mm-hmm. And what was he in prison for?
Breaking into cars when he was 15. They waited till he was 16 to try him as an adult.
Yeah.
And he ended up being sentenced to 8 to 16 years and serving 3 years in a day.
Right. Well, he was in occasional trouble with the law throughout his life and career.
That's true. Yes.
We're speaking with Douglas Wolk, who is the author of the book Live at the Apollo, and hearing some more of the audience participating in a big way in the background this the October night in 1962 when the album was recorded. There are moments, Douglas, throughout the record where you can hear James Brown practically conducting his band, you know, where they launch into a recognizable tune and then just as quickly and just as abruptly they stop on a dime and they turn and they start playing something else. How much of that was sort of premeditated, and how much of this was just on the spot?
It was pretty much entirely on the spot. People who've played with him say, when you play with James Brown, you have to watch James Brown. He would make little hand signals at them. They would stop on a dime. They would start on a dime. And he would fine his band if they missed a note. He would fine his band if their shoes weren't shined. They had to pay very close attention to everything he did.
So he was a disciplinarian, but he was not a perfectionist. I mean, you know, there are certainly rough edges that are, I assume, intentionally left showing on this record.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he put out plenty of records that have just missed notes or blown notes or bad singing or bad playing on them, just if it was a record that sounded good, if the feel was there, he'd put it out. There was no Pro Tools in those days.
No digital editing. All right, let's hear another clip, and then I want to ask you to sort of peel back the veil for us and, you know, tell us the true story of how this recording was made. But the story goes, it's live, one night, one show, October 24, 1962 at the Apollo. Here's a little more from James Brown and his band.
But I know you gonna miss me. Yeah, 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 yeah.
James Brown live at the Apollo. Douglas Wolk, I'll read to you from the original liner notes. I know you're familiar with all that it says, but, quote, "This album is the actual recording of the midnight show and includes the actual 40 minutes of James Brown on stage," unquote. True or false?
Almost true. For one thing, it's only half an hour long.
Right.
There are probably a few songs missing from it. For another thing, they recorded a couple of shows all that night. I mean, it was all recorded that night, but there's more than one show that it's pieced together from. And weirdly enough, the famous audience screams and give and take and interactions, some of that is real. Some of it, the mastering engineer went to a sock hop in Roselawn and, you know, recorded the audience there clapping and cheering. And they added a little bit of that to the record.
Okay.
So you're not hearing it exactly as it was.
Kind of like the famous Johnny Cash, you know, Live at Folsom Prison recording, where the
where the
applause that they later found out had been sort of tracked in separately. All right, well, the album, however it was made, certainly turned out to be a huge success, spent 66 weeks on the Billboard Pop LP chart. A huge crossover success for young James Brown and setting the stage for much of the music that would follow in the next 40 years. James Brown passed away on Christmas Day, and we've been speaking with Douglas Wolk. His book is Live at the Apollo. Douglas, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us for a little look back at some musical history. And in a moment, musical ecstasy of a very different kind. We turn to the trance music of Morocco. And then later, planning a winter getaway? We'll look at five musical hotspots to check out in 2007. This is Soundcheck.
I found someone to love me. I found someone to love me. I found someone to love me. I know it's true.
Why did it happen?
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.